Perhaps the sister has fallen asleep. They certainly have a great deal to do and are all overworked day after day, and added to that is the everlasting praying. "Should we smash a bottle?" asks Josef Hemmecker of the shooting license. She wouldn't hear that any more than the bell. At last the door opens. The old lady appears, mumbling. When she perceives Franz's trouble, she begins to bustle and says, "Why did not someone say I was wanted? We did ring, and none of us here can walk." He has been bleeding badly, and she binds him up. In the morning we look at his face. It has become sharp and yellow, whereas the evening before he looked almost healthy. Now a sister comes oftener. Sometimes there are Red Cross voluntary aid sisters. They are pleasant, but often rather unskilled. They frequently give us pain when remaking our beds, and then are so frightened that they hurt us still more. The nuns are more reliable. They know how they must take hold of us, but we would be better pleased if they were somewhat more cheerful. A few of them have real spirit. They are superb. There is no one but would do anything for Sister Libertine, this marvelous sister, who spreads good cheer through the whole wing, even when she can only be seen in the distance. And there are others like her. We would go through fire for her. A man cannot really complain. Here he is treated by the nuns exactly like a civilian. And just to think of a garrison hospital gives one the creeps. Franz Vector does not regain his strength. One day he is taken away and does not come back. Josef Hemmecker knows all about it. "We shan't see him again. They've put him in the dead room."
"What do you mean, dead room?" asks Krupp.
"Well, dying room."
"What is that, then?"
"A little room at the corner of the building. Whoever is about to kick the bucket is put in there. There are two beds in it. It is generally called the dying room."
"But what do they do that for?"
"They don't have so much work to do afterwards. It's more convenient, too, because it lies right beside the lift to the mortuary. Perhaps they do it for the sake of the others also, so that no one in the ward dies in sympathy. And they can look after him better, too, if he's by himself."
"But what about him?"
Josef shrugs his shoulders. "Usually he doesn't take much notice anymore."
"Does everybody know about it, then?"
"Anyone who has been here long enough knows, of course." In the afternoon, Franz Vector's bed has a fresh occupant. A couple of days later, they take the new man away, too. Josef makes a significant glance. We see many come and go. Often relatives sit by the beds and weep, or talk softly and awkwardly. One old woman will not go away, but she cannot stay there the whole night through. The next morning she comes very early, but not early enough, for when she goes up to the bed, someone else is in it already. She has to go to the mortuary. The apples that she has brought with her she gives to us. And then little Peter begins to get worse. His temperature chart looks bad, and one day the flat trolley stands beside his bed.
"Where to?" he asks.
"To the bandaging ward." He is lifted out. But the sister makes the mistake of removing his tunic from the hook and putting it on the trolley too, so that she should not have to make two journeys. Peter understands immediately and tries to roll off the trolley. "I'm stopping here." They push him back. He cries out feebly with his shattered lung, "I won't go to the dying room." "But we are going to the bandaging ward."
"Then what do you want my tunic for?"
He can speak no more. Hoarse, agitated, he whispers, "Stopping here." They do not answer, but wheel him out. At the door he tries to raise himself up. His black curly head sways. His eyes are full of tears.
"I will come back again. I will come back again," he cries.
The door shuts. We are all excited, but we say nothing. At last Josef says, "Many a man has said that. Once a man is in there, he never comes through." I am operated on and vomit for 2 days. My bones will not grow together, so the surgeon's secretary says. Another fellow's have grown crooked. His are broken again. It is damnable. Among our new arrivals, there are two young soldiers with flat feet. The chief surgeon discovers them on his rounds and is overjoyed. "We'll soon put that right," he tells them. "We'll just do a small operation, and then you will have perfectly sound feet. Enter them down, sister." As soon as he is gone, Yosef, who knows everything, warns them, "Don't you let him operate on you. That is a special scientific stunt of the old boy's. He goes absolutely crazy whenever he can get hold of anyone to do it on. He operates on you for flat feet, and there's no mistake. You don't have them anymore. You have club feet instead, and have to walk all the rest of your life on sticks."
"What should a man do, then?" asks one of them.
"Say no. You are here to be cured of your wound, not your flat feet. Did you have any trouble with them in the field? No, well, there you are. At present, you can still walk. But if once the old boy gets you under the knife, you'll be cripples. What he wants is little dogs to experiment with, so the war is a glorious time for him, as it is for all the surgeons. You take a look down below at the staff. There are a dozen fellows hobbling around that he has operated on. A lot of them have been here all the time, since 14 and 15. Not a single one of them can walk better than he could before, almost all of them worse, and most only with plaster legs. Every 6 months he catches them again and breaks their bones afresh, and every time is going to be the successful one. You take my word, he won't dare to do it if you say no."
"Ah, man," says one of the two wearily, "better your feet than your brain box. There's no telling what you'll get if you go back out there again. They can do with me just as they please, so long as I get back home. Better to have a club foot than be dead."
The other, a young fellow like ourselves, won't have it done. The next morning the old man has the two hauled up and lectures and jaws at them so long that in the end they consent. What else could they do? They are mere privates, and he is a big bug. They are brought back chloroformed and plastered. It is going badly with Albert. They have taken him and amputated his leg. The whole leg has been taken off from the thigh. Now he will hardly speak anymore. Once he says he will shoot himself the first time he can get hold of his revolver again. A new convoy arrives. Our room gets two blind men. One of them is a very youthful musician. The sisters never have a knife with them when they feed him. He has already snatched one from a sister. But in spite of this caution, there is an incident. In the evening, while he is being fed, the sister is called away and leaves the plate with the fork on his table. He gropes for the fork, seizes it, and drives it with all his force against his heart. Then he snatches up a shoe and strikes with it against the handle as hard as he can. We call for help, and three men are necessary to take the fork away from him. The blunt prongs had already penetrated deep. He abuses us all night so that no one can go to sleep. In the morning he has lockjaw. Again beds are empty. Day after day goes by with pain and fear, groans and death gurgles. Even the death room is no use anymore. It is too small. Fellows die during the night in our room. They go even faster than the sisters can cope with them. But one day the door flies open, the flat trolley rolls in, and there on the stretcher, pale, thin, upright, and triumphant, with his shaggy head of curls, sits Pater. Sister Libertine, with beaming looks, pushes him over to his former bed. He is back from the dying room. We have long supposed him dead. He looks round. "What do you say now?" And Yosef has to admit that it is the first time he has ever known of such a thing. Gradually, a few of us are allowed to get up, and I am given crutches to hobble around on, but I do not make much use of them. I cannot bear Albert's gaze as I move about the room. His eyes always follow me with such a strange look. So I sometimes escape to the corridor. There I can move about more freely. On the next floor below are the abdominal and spine cases, head wounds and double amputations. On the right side of the wing are the jaw wounds, wounds in the joints, wounds in the kidneys, wounds in the testicles, wounds in the intestines. Here a man realizes for the first time in how many places a man can get hit. Two fellows die of tetanus. Their skin turns pale, their limbs stiffen. At last only their eyes live stubbornly. Many of the wounded have their shattered limbs hanging free in the air from a gallows. Underneath the wound, a basin is placed into which drips the pus. Every 2 or 3 hours, the vessel is emptied. Other men lie in stretching bandages with heavy weights hanging from the end of the bed. I see intestine wounds that are constantly full of excreta. The surgeon's clerk shows me X-ray photographs of completely smashed hip bones, knees, and shoulders. A man cannot realize that above such shattered bodies there are still human faces in which life goes its daily round. And this is only one hospital, one single station. There are hundreds of thousands in Germany, hundreds of thousands in France, hundreds of thousands in Russia. How senseless is everything that can ever be written, done, or thought when such things are possible. It must be all lies, and of no account when the culture of 1,000 years could not prevent this stream of blood being poured out, these torture chambers in their hundreds of thousands. A hospital alone shows what war is. I am young. I am 20 years old. Yet I know nothing of life but despair, death, fear, and fatuous superficiality cast over an abyss of sorrow. I see how peoples are set against one another, and in silence, unknowingly, foolishly, obediently, innocently slay one another. I see that the keenest brains of the world invent weapons and words to make it yet more refined and enduring. And all men of my age, here and over there, throughout the whole world, see these things. All my generation is experiencing these things with me. What would our fathers do if we suddenly stood up and came before them and proffered our account? What do they expect of us if a time ever comes when the war is over? Through the years, our business has been killing. It was our first calling in life. Our knowledge of life is limited to death. What will happen afterwards? And what shall come out of us? The oldest man in our room is Lewandowski. He is 40 and has already lain 10 months in the hospital with a severe abdominal wound. Just in the last few weeks he has improved sufficiently to be able to hobble about doubled up. For some days past, he has been in great excitement. His wife has written to him from the little home in Poland where she lives, telling him that she has saved up enough money to pay for the fare and is coming to see him. She is already on the way and may arrive any day. Lewandowski has lost his appetite. He even gives away red cabbage and sausage after he has had a couple of mouthfuls. He goes round the room perpetually with the letter. Everyone has already read it 12 times. The postmarks have been examined heaven knows how often. The address is hardly legible any longer for spots of grease and thumb marks. And in the end, what is sure to happen, happens. Lewandowski develops a fever and has to go back to bed. He has not seen his wife for 2 years. In the meantime, she has given birth to a child whom she is bringing with her. But something else occupies Lewandowski's thoughts. He had hoped to get permission to go out when his old woman came, for obviously seeing is all very well, but when a man gets his wife again after such a long time, if at all possible, a man wants something else besides. Lewandowski has discussed it all with us at great length. In the army there were no secrets about such things, and what's more, nobody finds anything objectionable in it. Those of us who are already able to go out have told him of a couple of very good spots in the town, parks and squares where he would not be disturbed. One of us even knows of a little room. But what is the use? There Lewandowski lies in bed with his troubles. Life holds no more joy for him if he has to forego this affair. We console him and promise to get over the difficulty somehow or other. The next afternoon his wife appears.
a tousled little woman with anxious, quick eyes like a bird, in a sort of black, crinkly mantilla with ribbons. Heaven knows where she inherited the thing. She murmurs something softly and stands shyly in the doorway. It terrifies her that there are six of us men present. "Well, Maria," says Lewandowski and gulps dangerously with his Adam's apple, "you can come in all right, they won't hurt you." She goes round and proffers each of us her hand. Then she produces the child, which in the interval has done something in its napkin. From a large handbag embroidered with beads, she takes out a clean one and makes the child fresh and presentable. This dispels her first embarrassment, and the two begin to talk. Lewandowski is very fidgety. Every now and then he squints across at us most unhappily with his round, goggle eyes. The time is favorable. The doctor's visit is over. At the most, one of the sisters might come in. So one of us goes out to prospect. He comes back and nods. Not a soul to be seen. Now's your chance, Johann. Set to. The two speak together in an undertone. The woman turns a little red and looks embarrassed. We grin good-naturedly and make poo-pooing gestures. What does it matter? The devil take all conventions. They were made for other times. Here lies the carpenter Johann Lewandowski, a soldier shot to a cripple, and there is his wife. Who knows when he will see her again? He wants to have her, and he should have her. Good. Two men stand at the door to forestall the sisters and keep them occupied if they chance to come along. They agree to stand guard for a quarter of an hour or thereabouts. Lewandowski can only lie on his side, so one of us props a couple of pillows against his side. Albert gets the child to hold. We all turn round a bit. The black mantilla disappears under the bedclothes. We make a great clatter and play scat noisily. All goes well. I hold a club solo with four jacks, which nearly goes the round. In the process, we almost forget Lewandowski. After a while, the child begins to squall, although Albert, in desperation, rocks it to and fro. There is a bit of creaking and rustling, and as we look up casually, we see that the child has the bottle in its mouth and is back again with its mother. The business is over. We now feel ourselves like one big family. The woman is happy, and Lewandowski lies there sweating and beaming. He unpacks the embroidered handbag, and some good sausages come to light. Lewandowski takes up the knife with a flourish and saws the meat into slices. With a handsome gesture, he waves toward us, and the little woman goes from one to another and smiles at us and hands round the sausage. She now looks quite handsome. We call her mother. She is pleased and shakes up our pillows for us. After a few weeks, I have to go each morning to the massage department. There my leg is harnessed up and made to move. The arm is healed long since. New convoys arrive from the line. The bandages are no longer made of cloth, but of white crepe paper. Rag bandages have become scarce at the front. Albert's stump heals well. The wound is almost closed. In a few weeks he should go off to an institute for artificial limbs. He continues not to talk much and is much more solemn than formerly. He often breaks off in his speech and stares in front of him. If he were not here with us, he would have shot himself long ago. But now he is over the worst of it, and he often looks on while we play scat. I get convalescent leave. My mother does not want to let me go away. She is feeble. It is all much worse than it was last time. Then I am recalled to my regiment and return once more to the line. Parting from my friend Albert Krupp was very hard. But a man gets used to that sort of thing in the army. Chapter 11. We count the weeks no more. It was winter when I came up, and when the shells exploded, the frozen clods of earth were just as dangerous as the fragments. Now the trees are green again. Our life alternates between billets and the front. We have almost grown accustomed to it.
War is the cause of death, like cancer and tuberculosis, like influenza and dysentery. The deaths are merely more frequent, more varied, and terrible. Our thoughts are clay. They are molded with the changes of the days. When we are resting, they are good. Under fire, they are dead. Fields of craters within and without. Everyone is so, not only ourselves here. The things that existed before are no longer valid, and one practically knows them no more. Distinctions, breeding, education are changed, are almost blotted out, and hardly recognizable any longer. Sometimes they give an advantage for profiting by a situation, but they also bring consequences along with them, in that they arouse prejudices which have to be overcome. It is as though formerly we were coins of different provinces, and now we are melted down and all bear the same stamp. To rediscover the old distinctions, the metal itself must be tested. First we are soldiers, and afterwards, in a strange and shame-faced fashion, individual men as well. It is a great brotherhood, which adds something of the good fellowship of the folk song, of the feeling of solidarity of convicts, and of the desperate loyalty to one another of men condemned to death, to a condition of life arising out of the midst of danger, out of the tension and forlornness of death, seeking in a wholly unpathetic way a fleeting enjoyment of the hours as they come. If one wants to appraise it, it is at once heroic and banal. But who wants to do that? It is this, for example, that makes Chiadin spoon down his ham and pea soup in such tearing haste when an enemy attack is reported, simply because he cannot be sure that in an hour's time he will be alive. We have discussed it at length, whether it is right or not to do so. Cat condemns it, because he says a man has to reckon with the possibility of an abdominal wound, and that is more dangerous on a full stomach than on an empty one. Such things are real problems. They are serious matters to us. They cannot be otherwise. Here, on the borders of death, life follows an amazingly simple course. It is limited to what is most necessary. All else lies buried in gloomy sleep. In that, besides our primitiveness and our survival. Were we more subtly differentiated, we must long since have gone mad, have deserted, or have fallen. As in a polar expedition, every expression of life must serve only the preservation of existence, and is absolutely focused on that. All else is banished because it would consume energies unnecessarily. That is the only way to save ourselves. In the quiet hours, when the puzzling reflection of former days, like a blurred mirror, projects beyond me the figure of my present existence, I often sit over against myself, as before a stranger, and wonder how the unnameable active principle that calls itself to life has adapted itself even to this form. All other expressions lie in a winter sleep. Life is simply one continual watch against the menace of death. It has transformed us into unthinking animals in order to give us the weapon of instinct. It has reinforced us with dullness so that we do not go to pieces before the horror which would overwhelm us if we had clear conscious thought. It has awakened in us the sense of comradeship, so that we escape the abyss of solitude. It has lent us the indifference of wild creatures, so that in spite of all, we perceive the positive in every moment and store it up as a reserve against the onslaught of nothingness. Thus we live a closed, hard existence of the utmost superficiality, and rarely does an incident strike out a spark. But then, unexpectedly, a flame of grievous and terrible yearning flares up. Those are the dangerous moments. They show us that the adjustment is only artificial, that it is not simple rest, but sharpest struggle for rest. In the outward form of our life we are hardly distinguishable from bushmen, but whereas the latter can be so always because they are so truly, and at best may develop further by exertion of their spiritual forces, with us it is the reverse. Our inner forces are not exerted toward regeneration, but toward degeneration. The bushmen are primitive and naturally so, but we are primitive in an artificial sense, and by virtue of the utmost effort. And at night, waking out of a dream, overwhelmed and bewitched by the crowding apparitions, a man perceives with alarm how slight is the support, how thin the boundary that divides him from the darkness. We are little flames poorly sheltered by frail walls against the storm of dissolution and madness, in which we flicker and sometimes almost go out. Then the muffled roar of the battle becomes a ring that encircles us. We creep in upon ourselves and with big eyes stare into the night. Our only comfort is the steady breathing of our comrades asleep. And thus we wait for the morning. Every day and every hour, every shell and every death cuts into this thin support, and the years wasted rapidly. I see how it is already gradually breaking down around me. There is the mad story of Datering. He was one of those who kept himself to himself. His misfortune was that he saw a cherry tree in a garden. We were just coming back from the front line, and at a turning of the road near our billets, marvelous in the morning twilight, stood this cherry tree before us. It had no leaves, but was one white mass of blossom. In the evening, Datering was not to be seen. Then at last he came back and had a couple of branches of cherry blossom in his hand. We made fun of him and asked whether he was going to a wedding. He made no answer, but lay down on his bed. During the night I heard him making a noise. He seemed to be packing. I sensed something amiss and went over to him. He made out it was nothing, and I said to him, "Don't do anything silly, Datering." "Ach, why, it is merely that I can't sleep." "What did you pick the cherry branches for?" "Surely I can pick cherry blossom if I want to," he replied evasively. And after a while, "I have a big orchard with cherry trees at home. When they are in blossom, from the hayloft they look like one single sheet, so white. It is just the time. Perhaps you will get leave soon. You may even be sent back as a farmer." He nodded, but he was far away. When these peasants are excited, they have a curious expression, a mixture of cow and yearning god, half stupid and half rapt. In order to turn him away from his thoughts, I asked him for a piece of bread. He gave it to me without a murmur. That was suspicious, for he is usually tight-fisted. So I stayed awake. Nothing happened. In the morning he was as usual. Apparently he had noticed that I had been watching him, but the second morning he was gone. I noticed it, but said nothing in order to give him time. He might perhaps get through. Various fellows have already got into Holland. But at roll call he was missed. A week after, we heard that he had been caught by the field gendarmes, those despicable military police. He had headed toward Germany. That was hopeless, of course. And, of course, he did everything else just as idiotically. Anyone might have known that his flight was only homesickness and a momentary aberration. But what does a court-martial 100 miles behind the front line know about it? We have heard nothing more of Datering. But sometimes it broke out in other ways. This danger, these pent-up things, as from an overheated boiler. It will be enough to tell how Berger met his end. Our trenches have now, for some time, been shot to pieces, and we have an elastic line, so that there is practically no longer any proper trench warfare. When attack and counterattack have waged backwards and forwards, there remains a broken line and a bitter struggle from crater to crater. The front line has been penetrated, and everywhere small groups have established themselves. The fight is carried on from clusters of shell holes. We are in a crater. The English are coming down obliquely. They are turning our flank and working in behind us. We are surrounded. It is not easy to surrender. Fog and smoke hang over us. No one would recognize that we wanted to give ourselves up, and perhaps we don't want to. A man doesn't even know himself at such moments. We hear the explosions of the hand grenades coming towards us. Our machine gun sweeps over the semicircle in front of us. The cooling water evaporates. We hastily pass around the case. Every man pisses in it, and thus we again have water and are able to continue firing. But behind us the attack crashes ever nearer. A few minutes, and we are lost. Then, at closest range, a second machine gun bursts out. It is set up in a crater alongside us. Berger has fetched it, and now the counterattack comes over from behind. We are set free and make contact with the rear. Afterwards, as we lie in comparatively good cover, one of the food carriers reports that a couple of hundred yards distant, there lies a wounded messenger dog.
"Where?" asks Berger.
The other describes the place to him. Berger goes off, either to fetch the beast in or to shoot it. 6 months ago he would not have cared. He would have been reasonable. We try to prevent him. Then, as he goes off grimly, all we can say is, "You're mad," and let him go. For these cases of front-line madness become dangerous if one is not able to fling the man to the ground and hold him fast, and Berger is 6 feet and the most powerful man in the company. He is absolutely mad, for he has to pass through the barrage. But this lightning that lowers somewhere above us has struck him and made him demented. It affects others so that they begin to rave, to run away. There was one man who even tried to dig himself into the ground with hands, feet, and teeth. It is true such things are often simulated, but the pretense itself is a symptom. Berger, who means to finish off the dog, is carried away with a wound in the pelvis, and one of the fellows who carry him gets a bullet in the leg while doing it. Müller is dead. Someone shot him point-blank in the stomach with a Veery light. He lived for a half an hour, quite conscious and in terrible pain. Before he died, he handed over his pocketbook to me and bequeathed me his boots, the same that he once inherited from Kemmerich. I wear them, for they fit me quite well. After me, Tjaden will get them. I have promised them to him. We have been able to bury Müller, but he is not likely to remain long undisturbed. Our lines are falling back. There are too many fresh English and American regiments over there. There's too much corned beef and white wheaten bread. Too many new guns. Too many aeroplanes. But we are emaciated and starved. Our food is bad and mixed up with so much substitute stuff that it makes us ill. The factory owners in Germany have grown wealthy. Dysentery dissolves our bowels. The latrine poles are always densely crowded. The people at home ought to be shown these gray, yellow, miserable, wasted faces here, these bent figures from whose bodies the colic wrings out the blood, and who, with lips trembling and distorted with pain, grin at one another and say, "It's not much sense pulling up one's trousers again." Our artillery is fired out, but has too few shells, and the barrels are so worn that they shoot uncertainly and scatter so widely as even to fall on ourselves. We have too few horses. Our fresh troops are anemic boys in need of rest who cannot carry a pack but merely know how to die by thousands. They understand nothing about warfare. They simply go on and let themselves be shot down.
A single flyer routed two companies of them for a joke just as they came fresh from the train, before they had ever heard of such a thing as cover.
"Germany ought to be empty soon," says Cat.
We've given up hope that someday an end may come. We never think so far. A man can stop a bullet and be killed. He can get wounded, and then the hospital is his next stop. There, if they do not amputate him, he sooner or later falls into the hands of one of those staff surgeons who, with the War Service cross in his buttonhole, says to him, "What, one leg a bit short? Well, if you have any pluck, you don't need to run at the front. The man is A1. Dismiss." Cat tells a story that has traveled the whole length of the front from the Vosges to Flanders, of the staff surgeon who reads the names on the list, and when a man comes before him without looking up and says, "A1, we need soldiers up there." A fellow with a wooden leg comes up before him. The staff surgeon again says, "A1. And then, Cat raises his voice, the fellow says to him, "I already have a wooden leg. But when I go back again and they shoot off my head, then I will get a wooden head made and become a staff surgeon." This answer tickles us all immensely. There may be good doctors, and there are lots of them. All the same, every soldier, sometime during his hundreds of inspections, falls into the clutches of one of these countless hero-grabbers who pride themselves on changing as many C3s and B3s as possible into A1s. There are many such stories. They are mostly far more bitter. All the same, they have nothing to do with mutiny or lead-swinging. They are merely honest and call a thing by its name. For there's a very great deal of fraud, injustice, and baseness in the army. It is nothing that regiment after regiment returns again and again to the ever more hopeless struggle, that attack follows attack along the weakening, retreating, crumbling line. From a mockery, the tanks have become a terrible weapon. Armored, they come rolling on in long lines, more than anything else embody for us the horror of war. We do not see the guns that bombard us. The attacking lines of the enemy infantry are men like ourselves, but these tanks are machines. Their caterpillars run on as endless as the war. They are annihilation. They roll without feeling into the craters and climb up again without stopping, a fleet of roaring, smoke-belching armor-clads, invulnerable steel beasts squashing the dead and the wounded. We shrivel up in our thin skin before them. Against their colossal weight, our arms are sticks of straw and our hand grenades matches. Shells, gas clouds, and flotillas of tanks, shattering, corroding death. Dysentery, influenza, typhus, scalding, choking death. Trenches, hospitals, the common grave. There are no other possibilities. In one attack, our company commander, Bertink, falls. He was one of those superb frontline officers who are foremost in every hot place. He was with us for 2 years without being wounded, so that something had to happen in the end. We occupy a crater and get surrounded. The stink of petroleum or oil blows across with the fumes of powder. Two fellows with a flamethrower are seen. One carries the tin on his back. The other has the hose in his hands from which the fire spouts. If they get so near that they can reach us, we are done for. We cannot retreat yet. We open fire on them. But they work nearer, and things begin to look bad. Bertink is lying in the hole with us. When he sees that we cannot hit them because under the sharp fire we have to think too much about keeping under cover, he takes a rifle, crawls out of the hole, and lying down, propped on his elbows, he takes aim. He fires. The same moment a bullet smacks into him. They have got him. Still he lies and aims again. Once he shifts and again takes aim. At last the rifle cracks. Bertink lets the gun drop and says, "Good," and slips back into the hole. The hindermost of the two flamethrowers is hit. He falls. The hose slips away from the other fellow. The fire squirts about on all sides, and the man burns. Bertink has a chest wound. After a while, a fragment smashes away his chin, and the same fragment has sufficient force to tear open Lear's hip. Lear groans as he supports himself on his arm. He bleeds quickly. No one can help him. Like an emptying tube, after a couple of minutes, he collapses. What use is it to him now that he was such a good mathematician at school? The months pass by. The summer of 1918 is the most bloody and the most terrible. The days stand like angels in blue and gold, incomprehensible, above the ring of annihilation. Every man here knows that we are losing the war. Not much is said about it. We are falling back. We will not be able to attack again after this big offensive. We have no more men and no more ammunition. Still the campaign goes on. The dying goes on. Summer of 1918. Never has life in its niggardliness seemed to us so desirable as now. The red poppies in the meadows round our billets, the smooth beetles on the blades of grass, the warm evenings in the cool, dim rooms, the black, mysterious trees of the twilight, the stars in the flowing waters, dreams and long sleep. Oh, life, life, life. Summer of 1918. Never was so much silently suffered as in the moment when we depart once again for the front line. Wild, tormenting rumors of an armistice and peace are in the air. They lay hold on our hearts and make the return to the front harder than ever. Summer of 1918. Never was life in the line more bitter and full of horror than in the hours of the bombardment, when the blanched faces lie in the dirt and the hands clutch at the one thought, no, no, not now, not now, at the last moment. Summer of 1918. Breath of hope that sweeps over the scorched fields, raging fever of impatience, of disappointment, of the most agonizing terror of death, insensate question, why? Why do they make an end? And why do these rumors of an end fly about? There are so many airmen here, and they are so sure of themselves that they give chase to single individuals, just as though they were hares. For every one German plane, there come at least five English and American. For one hungry, wretched German soldier, come five of the enemy, fresh and fit. For one German army loaf, there are 50 tins of canned beef over there. We are not beaten. For as soldiers, we are better and more experienced. We are simply crushed and driven back by overwhelming superior forces. Behind us lay rainy weeks. Gray sky, gray fluid earth, gray dying. If we go out, the rain at once soaks through our overcoat and clothing, and we remain wet all the time we are in the line. We never get dry. Those who will wear high boots tie sandbags round the tops so that the mud does not pour in so fast. The rifles are caked, the uniforms caked. Everything is fluid and dissolved, the earth one dripping, soaked, oily mass in which lie yellow pools with red spiral streams of blood and into which the dead, wounded, and survivors slowly sink down. The storm lashes us out of the confusion of gray and yellow. The hail of splinters whips forth the childlike cries of the wounded, and in the night shattered life groans painfully into silence. Our hands are earth, our bodies clay, and our eyes pools of rain. We do not know whether we still live. Then the heat sinks heavily into our shell holes like a jellyfish, moist and oppressive.
And on one of these late summer days, while bringing food, Cat falls. We two are alone. I bind up his wound. His shin seems to be smashed. It has got the bone. And Cat groans desperately. At last, just at the last. I comfort him. Who knows how long this mess will go on yet? Now you are saved. The wound begins to bleed fast. Cat cannot be left by himself while I try to find a stretcher. Anyway, I don't know of a stretcher-bearer's post in the neighborhood. Cat is not very heavy, so I take him up on my back and start off to the dressing station with him. Twice we rest. He suffers acutely on the way. We do not speak much. I have opened the collar of my tunic and breathe heavily. I sweat, and my face is swollen with the strain of carrying. All the same, I urge him to let us go on, for the place is dangerous. Shall we go on again, Cat? Must, Paul. Then come. I raise him up. He stands on the uninjured leg and supports himself against a tree. I take up the wounded leg carefully. Then he gives a jump, and I take the knee of the sound leg also under my arm. The going is more difficult. Often a shell whistles across. I go as quickly as I can, for the blood from Cat's wound drips to the ground. We cannot shelter ourselves properly for the explosions. Before we can take cover, the danger is all over. We lie down in a small hole to wait till the shelling is over. I give Cat some tea from my water bottle. We smoke a cigarette. Well, Cat, I say gloomily, we're going to be separated at last. He is silent and looks at me. Do you remember, Cat, how we commandeered the goose? And how you brought me out of the barrage when I was still a young recruit and was wounded for the first time? I cried then. Cat, that is almost 3 years ago. He nods. The anguish of solitude rises up in me. When Cat is taken away, I will not have one friend left. Cat, in any case, we must see one another again, if it is peacetime before you come back. Do you think that I'll be marked A1 again with his leg? He asks bitterly. With rest, it will get better. The joint is quite sound. It may get all right again. Give me another cigarette, he says. Perhaps we could do something together later on, Cat. I am very miserable. It is impossible that Cat, my friend, Cat with the drooping shoulders and the poor thin mustache, Cat whom I know as I know no other man, Cat with whom I have shared these years. It is impossible that perhaps I shall not see Cat again. In any case, give me your address at home, Cat, and here is mine. I will write it down for you. I write his address in my pocketbook. How forlorn I am already, though he still sits here beside me. Couldn't I shoot myself quickly in the foot so as to be able to go with him? Suddenly Cat gurgles and turns green and yellow. Let us go on, he stammers. I jump up, eager to help him. I take him up and start off at a run, a slow, steady pace, so as not to jolt his leg too much. My throat is parched. Everything dances red and black before my eyes. I stagger on doggedly and pitilessly, and at last reach the dressing station. There I drop down on my knees, but have still enough strength to fall onto the side where Cat's sound leg is. After a few minutes, I straighten myself up again. My legs and my hands tremble. I have trouble in finding my water bottle to take a pull. My lips tremble as I try to think. But I smile. Cat is saved. After a while, I begin to sort out the confusion of voices that falls on my ears. You might have spared yourself that, says an orderly. I look at him without comprehending. He points to Cat.
He is stone dead. I do not understand him. He's been hit in the shin, I say. The orderly stands still. That as well. I turn round. My eyes are still dulled. The sweat breaks out on me again. It runs over my eyelids. I wipe it away and peer at Cat. He lies still. Fainted, I say quickly. The orderly whistles softly. I know better than that. He's dead. I'll lay any money on that. I shake my head. Not possible. Only 10 minutes ago I was talking to him. He has fainted. Cat's hands are warm. I pass my hand under his shoulders in order to rub his temples with some tea. I feel my fingers become moist. As I draw them away from behind his head, they are bloody. You see? The orderly whistles once more through his teeth. On the way, without my having noticed it, Cat has caught a splinter in the head. There's just one little hole. It must have been a very tiny, stray splinter. But it has sufficed. Cat is dead. Slowly I get up. Would you like to take his paybook and his things? The lance corporal asks me. I nod, and he gives them to me. The orderly is mystified. You're not related, are you? No, we are not related. No, we are not related. Do I walk? Have I feet still? I raise my eyes. I let them move round and turn myself with them. One circle. One circle, and I stand in the midst. All is as usual. Only the militiaman Stanislaus Kaczynski has died. Then I know nothing more. Chapter 12. It is autumn. There are not many of the old hands left. I am the last of the 7 fellows from our class. Everyone talks of peace and armistice. All wait. If it again proves an illusion, then they will break up. Hope is high. It cannot be taken away again without an upheaval. If there is not peace, then there will be revolution. I have 14 days rest because I have swallowed a bit of gas. In the little garden, I sit the whole day long in the sun. The armistice is coming soon. I believe it now, too. Then we will go home. Here my thoughts stop. I will not go any farther. All that meets me, all that floods over me, are but feelings. Greed of life, love of home, yearning for the blood, intoxication of deliverance, but no aims. Had we returned home in 1916, out of the suffering and the strength of our experience, we might have unleashed a storm. Now, if we go back, we will be weary, broken, burnt out, rootless, and without hope. We will not be able to find our way anymore. And men will not understand us. For the generation that grew up before us, though it has passed these years with us, already had a home and a calling. Now it will return to its old occupations, and the war will be forgotten. And the generation that has grown up after us will be strange to us and push us aside. We will be superfluous, even to ourselves. We will grow older. A few will adapt themselves, some others will merely submit, and most will be bewildered. The years will pass by, and in the end we shall fall into ruin. But perhaps all this that I think is mere melancholy and dismay, which will fly away as the dust when I stand once again beneath the poplars
and listen to the rustling of their leaves. It cannot be that it has gone. The yearning that made our blood unquiet, the unknown, the perplexing, the oncoming things, the thousand faces of the future, the melodies from dreams and from books, the whispers and divinations of women. It cannot be that this has vanished in bombardment, in despair, in brothels. Here the trees show gay and golden, the berries of the rowan stand red among the leaves, country roads run white out to the skyline, and the canteens hum like beehives with rumors of peace. I stand up. I am very quiet. Let the months and years come. They can take nothing from me. They can take nothing more. I am so alone and so without hope that I can confront them without fear. The life that has borne me through these years is still in my hands and my eyes. Whether I have subdued it, I know not. But so long as it is there, it will seek its own way out, heedless of the will that is within me. He fell in October 1918. On a day that was so quiet and still on the whole front that the army report confined itself to the single sentence, "All quiet on the Western Front." He had fallen forward and lay on the earth as though sleeping. Turning him over, one saw that he could not have suffered long. His face had an expression of calm, as though almost glad the end had come.
The End. You've been listening to All Quiet on the Western Front by Eric Maria Remarque, narrated by Frank Muller.